talk with Art Bell. Call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
With one of the smartest people in the world. My guest is Dr. Michio Kaku, and he is indeed one of the world's leading theoretical physicists. It's fascinating to listen to, so I suggest you stay right where you are. Once again, Dr. Michio Kaku. All right, I guess we better do this. Mark in East Lansing, Michigan, obviously may not have heard our early programs, Professor, and simply asked, what is a type 3 civilization life form as opposed to, say, a type 1 you were just talking about? Please explain. Now, you've done that a number of times, but there are new people out there, so by all means.
Okay, and before I do that, let me just mention my webpage, if you don't mind.
Not at all.
It's www.mkaku.org, mkaku.org. And you can see a description of my new book, Parallel Worlds. And I'd like to thank Michael Phillips and Corey for setting up the webpage. They've done a great job monitoring the webpage. 40 million hits on that webpage so far.
40 million hits.
A fraction of your number of hits, of course.
I'm sure
a lot of my hits are spillovers from yours.
Happy to be delivering whatever hits you can take.
Well, briefly, a type 1 civilization is a planetary civilization that harnesses planetary power. They control the weather, they would control earthquakes, and that tsunami, for example, that devastated the Indian Ocean, that would be easily controlled by a type 1 civilization that controls anything planetary.
All right, stopping there for a second, folks. He's describing a type 1. We are a zero.
We're zero.
Zero.
We get our energy from dead plants, oil and coal.
Right.
We can barely predict the weather, let alone modify it or change it. We're at the mercy of earthquakes and volcanoes and tsunamis. A type 1 is about 100 years away from us in technology, but they control planetary forces.
That's not very far, 100 years.
Not very far. You can see the beginnings of it. You know, the internet is the beginning of a type 1 telephone system. That's what the internet really is.
Can
be the language of type 1.
Can you even imagine, Professor, how a type 1 might have, say, controlled or stopped or prevented or, I don't know, whatever, with that tsunami?
Well, first of all, they would be able to look inside the Earth. We're very primitive in terms of using earthquake waves to monitor the inside of the Earth. They'd be able to look inside the Earth and be able to predict well ahead of time and be able to release the energy. Release the energy slowly of these earthquakes before they build up, and we're at the mercy of these forces because we cannot see inside the Earth. However, with supercomputers, with sensors, and eventually neutrino telescopes, we may be able to actually see inside the Earth.
But how would even a type 1 civilization control the movement of tectonic plates against each other? That's what it is, right?
Well, for example, it's known that if you flood certain areas, just ordinary water will loosen some of the fault lines and actually initiate some rumbles in the fault. They would be able to precisely, in three-dimensional geometry, locate where all the pressure points are and relieve them using water, lubricants, or whatever kinds of advanced technology they have. They would know exactly where the pressure points are, relieve them so they're not going to build up, so the tectonic plates slide over each other without locking.
Is there research like that going on, Professor? I've heard little bits and pieces about injecting water and its effect.
It's very primitive because we don't know where the pressure points are. Just only in the last few years have we got the first map of the inside magma of the Earth. if you were actually to look at the core of the Earth and see all the streams of magma, it sort of looks like an onion with thin tendrils coming out of the onion. I was quite shocked when I saw that picture. We have just a rough approximation now of all the magma channels that are inside the Earth. Very rough picture.
That's fascinating.
I was quite astonished when I saw that picture.
How far down do we have knowledge of?
Well, this picture was taken of the entire core of the planet Earth, and it was done by looking at supercomputer analysis of waves caused by earthquakes as they went through the planet Earth itself, bounced off different layers, and then using a supercomputer to reconstruct in three dimensions the shape of all the junk inside the Earth.
Okay, so this is kind of on a scale of what a geologist does when they're looking for oil. They drop some dynamite in a hole, they let her rip, and then the vibrations come back and are put together by a computer.
Right.
Is that the same sort of thing?
Yeah, and a Type 1 civilization would have monitors over the entire planet Earth and have very precise sensing devices that allow a supercomputer to then reconstruct the entire shape of the interior of the Earth. The magma in the Earth looks very much like a potato, by the way, with tendrils and vines coming out of it in all sorts of irregular ways.
Well, you say you saw that. Where did you see
it's
this?
It's been published in science magazines. I'll look for it, and maybe I'll put it on my website. But seismologists have been able to construct the first crude picture of the inside of the Earth.
Wow.
Now, Type 1 civilization would have an accurate description of all the pressure points and where all the tectonic plates are jammed, and be able to loosen them precisely rather than using, witchcraft and all sorts of different kinds of, imprecise ways of trying to locate where the pressure is building up. And, of course, the pressure is building up miles underneath the surface of the Earth.
Yes.
So a Type 1 civilization would have the energy, would have the know-how, the supercomputers, to accurately reconstruct not just the inside of the Earth, but weather patterns also. They'd be able to modify the weather, be able to stop hurricanes before they form. They would have a tremendous understanding of the weather patterns and any planetary force they'd be able to control. Now, Type 2 has exhausted the power of a planet.
Before you start down on a Type 2, how much distance in time, Professor, would there be, say, between a Type 1 that we're fairly close to and a Type 2?
Between Type 1 and Type 2 is about 5,000 years. And you can calculate that number by looking at the rate at which the gross domestic product of nations increases. Energy consumption is very closely tied to gross domestic product, which grows at about 2% a year. And at a rate of 2% a year, we will hit Type 1 in about 100 years. We'll hit Type 2 in roughly 5,000 years. And we'll hit Type 3, which is galactic, at about 100,000 years to maybe a million years, depending upon whether we can perfect warp drive. So this is the progression of civilizations. And, like I said, we're about 100 years away from Type 1. And every headline I see in the newspaper leads me to believe that we're seeing the birth pangs of Type 1. The formation of the European Union is a Type 1, beginning of a Type 1 economy. And they formed to oppose NAFTA, which is us, North American Fair Trade Agreement.
Right.
And culture is even becoming Type 1. Blue jeans, rock and roll, rap music. That's a universal Type 1 culture being formed right before our eyes.
Rap music is part of Type 1?
Beginning of a planetary culture, blue jeans, rock and roll, youth culture is becoming universal and planetary. Also, there are people who in their gut understand that we're headed for Type 1 and don't like it. These are the terrorists. In their gut, they know that a planetary civilization is in formation, and they feel more comfortable living 1,000 years in the past at a minus one civilization. And so terrorism is a byproduct of the fact that we are marching toward Type 1. And I think that a planetary civilization is in the cards. You can see signs of it everywhere.
And do you think that those people who oppose our present momentum, Professor, would, if they could, destroy what's left of our Type 0 and 7/8 to prevent us from getting to Type 1? In other words, would they destroy the entire planet and all those who live on it if they had that capability to prevent the Type 1?
Well, I think that one reason perhaps why we don't see lots of aliens in outer space is that perhaps they did not make the transition between zero and one. That's the most dangerous transition of all time. By the time you're type two, you are immortal. Nothing known to science can destroy a type two civilization. But type zeros are extremely vulnerable.
Yes, being absolutely honest, this is the sad, hard-to-take part, folks. The hopeful part is that we could get to be a type one. The downside of this is that the odds of a zero getting to a one, especially through this dangerous period that we're in right now, are approximately what, Professor?
Well, my friend Sir Martin Rees, who's the Royal Astronomer of England, tried to make that estimate, and he put it at 50-50.
Oh.
Which I think is a little bit generous.
Oh.
But the Royal Astronomer of Great Britain put it at 50-50 that we'll make type 1.
Well, it's extremely optimistic. Some of the numbers you imagined, a year or so ago, much worse.
A lot worse, right?
Much worse, yes.
Yeah. However, like I said before, there are people who want to resist the transition to type 1, and want to get access to nuclear weapons, chemical weapons, biological weapons,
That's
and
right.
create all sorts of mischief.
That's right.
Not to mention global warming. And all the havoc that could happen in
let's
the
mention,
jet stream.
World. Oh, let's do it. Let's mention global warming for a second. I just read a book that I'll tell you about after the bottom of the hour that was anti-global warming. It's a brand new book called State of Fear. I'll tell you about it. Anyway, if you look now at the north part of the world and the south part of the world, and you really look at these satellite photos that go back, 50 years or whatever, it'll just scare the pants off you. I mean, the North Pole is melting, the Antarctic is calving, and
Alaska is thawing out. Every glacier on the Earth is receding.
Yes, yes. This seems so important to me, Professor, as though there's a change going on that eventually might not allow for, human life on the planet.
Well, maybe one day when we reach other planetary systems, we'll find that their atmospheres are too hot to support life because they had a greenhouse effect, or their atmospheres are radioactive because they had a nuclear war. So I think it's a warning to us that not every civilization makes it to type one.
Well, when you look at present environmental trends, are you encouraged or discouraged?
I think it's going to get worse before it gets better. I think it's going to take a major shock. I think it's going to take a major, major shock before politicians get off their butt and do something. We're talking about major storms that are going to inundate cities because of the rising of the sea level, the warming of the water to create hurricanes. We're going to see the disruption of the seasons so that, again, farmers are going to complain that their crops are devastated.
Uh-huh.
We'll see dust bowls forming. We'll see mosquitoes rising north carrying malaria. It's going to take a major catastrophe before the politicians do anything. And that's human nature, unfortunately. Humans don't do anything until they have to. But I think that's what's going to happen. Basically, nothing will happen until some catastrophe happens that threatens the breadbasket of the nations, swamps cities, inundates whole nations, and creates unmitigated havoc.
Can you imagine what sort of event or the magnitude of the event it would take to actually do that?
Well, for example, a nor'easter almost paralyzed all of New York City, where I live, putting water into the subway system.
Yes.
As water levels rise, New York City will not go underwater, but storms will easily loft water right into Manhattan and paralyze America's metropolitan center. Wall Street could be flooded. And again, sea levels will not inundate Wall Street, but storms will lift water right into the subway system and basically grind New York City to a halt. So I think things like that in San Francisco, New Orleans, Los Angeles, things like that will make the politicians really begin to wonder about this global warming business.
And you do anticipate an event of that magnitude?
I think that's what it's going to take. Right now, Alaska is thawing out. However, Alaska does not have that many electoral votes. Already in Alaska, we see the tundra beginning to thaw out. The highway systems are collapsing because the tundra underneath is melting.
Absolutely.
Apartment complexes are beginning to crack because their foundations are melting.
The news of what's happening in Alaska is not making it to the lower 48 in the way that it ought to be. What do you make out of that?
Well, unfortunately, the media is concentrated in places like New York City. So when Alaska thaws out, people say, well, it's nothing but a bunch of polar bears. but when Wall Street is underwater, I think people are going to think twice about this global warming business.
Well, they definitely would at that point. But right now, there are astounding... I mean, they're canceling traditional dog races because there's no snow. I got an email from a guy up at Prudhoe Bay... Earlier tonight, I read it. It's warm up at Prudhoe Bay. Let's see. Here it is. I see. Here he is. He's up at Prudhoe Bay at the oil field, and he's writing that it's raining up there right now. Professor, raining. This is January in Prudhoe Bay. Raining in Prudhoe Bay. That doesn't make sense.
Yeah, and the seasons are all getting knocked out of kilter. The early bird may not get the worm anymore because worms and birds have different cycles.
Yes.
And they're being set a kilter because the seasons are being disrupted now. Farmers are getting increasingly worried about when to plant their crops because of the changing of the seasons.
This lady called me in the first hour of the program from, I forget, somewhere in the south. Might have been Georgia. Anyway, she was saying that... there was black mold, this really weird black mold, growing on the soy crops down there. And there were projections this black mold may make it to the Midwest within the year or so. It would affect many, many crops. Wouldn't this kind of thing, this mold or other weird little things like that, sort of be a sideshow event to a major climate change?
I think so. And wait till it starts to disrupt the economy. America produces food, exports large quantities of food, has tremendous bread baskets in the Midwest and California and Florida. Wait till the agriculture of this country is disrupted. Then you get to see a lot of angry farmers taking it to the ballot box. So I think, the politicians are being very coy about this.
Thing
is not going to happen during my watch.
That's right.
So why should I worry about it?
That's right.
But, yeah, it'll happen. It'll begin to affect the ballot box as people's pocketbooks begin to get affected.
We're not long-range thinkers.
No, and that's why, some people say that we're not going to make it to Type 1.
Well, wouldn't those people be the place to put your money?
We'll wait and see.
I don't want to be that dark, but it just seems like maybe I'm not seeing the good parts of the course we're on right now.
Yeah, well, I think it's up to all of us to put a little heat underneath the rear ends of some of the politicians who say it's not going to happen in my watch, so I'm not going to do anything about it. Let the next politician take the heat for global warming. That's their attitude.
Well... what about other nations around the world?
Well, China's coming up really strong now in their economy, and they're under a lot of pressure now to get their act together to make sure that they don't start to belch tremendous amounts of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere.
But that is what they're beginning to do. I visited China. A friend of mine just got back a week ago from Shenzhen province, for example, which has now... I don't know. There were a couple hundred thousand when I was there. Now I'm told there are millions and millions and millions of people in Shenzhen. And the amount of commerce would just scare you to death. So that's the direction they're going in. In fact, they're beginning to take over. So,
as the world industrializes, I think that we all politicians are going to have to wonder what kind of world are we going to live in. We're going to create a vibrant economy with a living standard that people can afford and air that's breathable. And a weather system that we can predict and is friendly, or will the weather turn on us? That's a question that all of us are going to have to ask, but it's happening right before our eyes now.
Well, I can tell you this. It's only a microcosm at any given snapshot moment with regard to the weather, but the number of calls that I've been getting just from people around, well, the world, including Alaska, the Alaskans come on here and warn us like crazy. They say you wouldn't believe what's happening up here. but it just, it's not, I don't know, somehow it's heard, but it's not registering, or I can't figure it out.
Yeah, well, I think that when I look in the night sky and look at all those planets out there that perhaps are lurking and perhaps harbor life, they may have had the same problem centuries ago, thousands of years ago, and some of them may not have made it.
Maybe that's why it's so dark out there and we don't have any signals yet. Professor, hold on. From the high desert, I'm Art Bell. We will be right back.
Bell. Call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
It is, and my guest is Professor Michio Kaku, one of the brightest men in the world. And we're talking about all sorts of things that indeed impact our world. If you'll just stay right there, we'll be right back. Every now and then, it's very important to know what the other side is doing. Now, I, too, fancy myself to be an environmentalist. Michael Crichton has written a book, ostensibly, yes, fiction, but very much on the edge of fiction, much in the way that I think the coming global superstorm was framed. We made it fiction for a number of reasons, but there were... nuggets of truth in it, as there are in Michael Crichton's book. But boy, I thought it was a hack job. Nevertheless, I like Michael Crichton as a writer, so I read it. It is the antithesis, of course, of global superstorm, and the essence of it is, and this is what I want to discuss with the professor, the essence of the book is, again called State of Fear. And it's suggesting that the American people, indeed the world's people, must constantly be kept in a state of fear about something. Whether it's the communist menace, or it's, you know, what the Nazis, or whatever it is, the world must be kept in a state of fear. And the current state of fear being perpetrated is the environmental movement. And that the whole thing is absolute bunk. The environmental movement is bunk. And in this fictional story, environmentalists are seen to do things like, oh, I don't know, calving icebergs from the South Pole with bombs in order to forward the, affecting the weather, doing various things to show that the global warming is real. In other words, the global warming people are running around perpetrating these things in order to forward the idea that global warming is real when actually there's not an ounce of truth to it all. It's a remarkable book. You should read it if you get the opportunity, Professor. So there are a lot of people who believe that, Professor, that the whole environmental thing is absolute bunk, and it's just the state of fear that we need to be kept in. And I think it's time somebody said straight out whether or not this is real. I mean, if it's bunk and just a state of fear, then we should ignore it and pay attention to other things. Or is the whole environmental question a very real, pressing question, real or not?
Well, I think Michael Crichton is a very good science fiction writer. He writes these techno thrillers. He takes germ of truth and then blows that out of proportion. They're techno thrillers and they're science fiction. So I think we should treat this book just like that, as science fiction. However, you don't have to have eco-terrorists calve icebergs with dynamite. They're doing it by themselves. You don't have to have environmentalists create all the problems of Alaska, the North Pole, the South Pole, the glaciers. Mother Nature is doing that by itself because it's being egged on by human activity. And so I think that he's giving the environmentalists too much credit. It takes an enormous amount of effort to go to the South Pole and knock off an iceberg.
I wonder if he proposes the Alaskans in mass have turned their hair dryers on the tundra.
Yeah, and, you know, the atmosphere is heating up all by itself because of all the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. You know, when this debate was first emerging, I was a little bit skeptical myself. However, what turned my mind was a graph showing temperature and carbon dioxide level correlations going back 100,000 years. Mm-hmm. We can now go back actually several 100,000 years by drilling into the North Pole and South Pole and extracting ice cores. And by analyzing the weather patterns hundreds of thousands of years ago, you find that there's a lockstep between carbon dioxide and temperature levels, like a roller coaster, two roller coasters in lockstep. And it's peaking now. The 1990s went down as the hottest decade ever recorded in the history of science, going back 100,000 years.
That's right.
Now, you have to really be, I think, stretching it to think that humans had nothing to do with the fact that just now, because of the Industrial Revolution, and just within the last 10 years, we've had the hottest decade ever recorded going back, I think the record now is 400,000 years is the latest number I've seen. So I think that, to me, really clinched it. It's human activity. And it's not just, you know, sun cycles, and it's not just weather patterns and normal fluctuations. We see the normal fluctuations going back hundreds of thousands of years. But why now? Why in the last decade? And 2004 went down as, what, the third or fourth hottest year ever recorded in the history of science.
All right, well, as a scientist, that convinced you.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow the charts didn't make it to the Oval Office morning briefing or something. At any rate, certainly the politicians haven't registered one little bit with them yet, not at all.
Well, you know, there is a problem, and that is economic activity correlates with carbon dioxide.
Yes.
The United States produces one quarter of the world's carbon dioxide, but it also has one quarter of the world's economic activity. There's almost a one-to-one correlation between conventional wealth, the wealth of petroleum, and carbon dioxide production. And that's why, you know, the people who do produce carbon dioxide, the oil companies, the coal companies, they're going to resist any measures to rein in their profits by tooth and nail.
Gee, though, Professor, you know, it's just being realistic here for a second. And looking at China and looking at the other emerging nations that are coming in.
You know, they watch Hollywood movies and they want the Hollywood lifestyle.
They absolutely do. And it's headed in that direction, whether we like it or not. I don't see any force on earth that can stop it.
And so instead of trying to resist it, I think we should go with the flow and get the nations of India and China to wake up to the fact that they're going to be sacrificing their future generations by, you know, building coal plants and oil plants rather than going into conservation and solar energy and wind power and renewables.
But how do we convince them of that when we're having our success consuming our 25% or whatever it is of the world's reserves in this area?
Yeah, well, I think we're beginning to look like a bunch of hypocrites, right? On one hand, telling people that they have to get their act together, and, you know, America's always lecturing other countries.
Yeah, it doesn't sell well.
And it doesn't sound good when we're the biggest spender in terms of carbon dioxide and dumping the most pollution in the air. It doesn't look good at all.
Well, so just for the sake of the conversation, we should assume that they're not going to take our advice and they are going to proceed full speed ahead into probably being the leading, China, for example, leading emitter and user and so forth and so on. So what I guess I'm interested in is, what does that mean and how soon does it mean it?
Well, like I said, unfortunately, I don't see much happening with regards to the big nations until there is some kind of catastrophe that affects everybody. You realize that, 100, 150 years ago, there were no sewer systems in the major cities of the world until there were huge cholera and disease epidemics that killed rich people as well.
Right.
And when that happened, then the rich people clamored to have a sewer system. Well, gee, I mean, a little bit of self-interest was involved, but that's what it took. It took a disaster that wiped out rich people before the rich people of Paris and London decided to build their sewer systems. And I think it's going to happen that way, too. I mean, you know, people that live in, you know, have limousines and nice offices in Wall Street, they have beach houses. And when their beach houses get torn apart by monster hurricanes and flooded, I think they're going to realize that, hey, maybe there is something to this global warming business. But I think that it's going to take some kind of catastrophe before people wake up and the politicians feel the heat.
Well, at present rates of increased emissions and global warming, attendant global warming, would you take a guess, or do you know anybody who would take a guess about where the breaking point would begin to be where we might have an event of the proportion you're talking about?
Well, I think Florida, with all the hurricanes, was a wake-up call, not in the sense that it was directly related to the greenhouse effect. It could have been a fluctuation. But we are going to have more monster storms like this. And, you know, these people vote. And they're going to say, I can't get insurance.
Uh-huh.
My beachfront property, you know, no one wants to buy it. My nest egg for retirement just evaporated. And no one's doing anything about it. And just remember that hurricanes get their power from warm water.
Sure.
And the temperature of the water is heating up.
So these events, it could happen any time, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. In other words, trying to get an idea of, with what we see in terms of the scale of development.
And I think in 5 to 10 years, we're going to see monster disruptions of the weather. Look at Europe. There were tens of thousands of people that suffered, and many died because of the heat wave that paralyzed Europe over the summer.
Yes.
Many of them children and elderly.
Oh, yes.
And I think we're going to see more monster typhoons and hurricanes. Japan recorded a record number of typhoons, and Florida, of course, got hit so many times by hurricanes. And that's going to be commonplace. We're going to see very common extremes of weather, extreme heat, extreme wetness, and extreme drought. And I think that these things will gradually become part of everyday living. We're going to be used to the fact that Florida is unlivable. And so I think that these people are going to get very angry. Farmers are going to get angry that their foods are rotting on the vine and dust bowls are being created.
Well, you actually began to see a little bit of it after this last hurricane season. There were people who very seriously talked about, that's it. I'm out of here. I'm out of Florida. Well, I'm sure a lot of them after the hurricanes quit probably calmed down and remained. But if there was yet another year of this or even worse, and it keeps getting worse, it wouldn't be very many years before people said that in Florida and meant it and just flat left.
Yeah, I think in 5 to 10 years, you're going to see major, major changes in property values, major, major changes in people's lifestyle and pocketbooks. And it's not 20, 30 years. We're talking about monster storms, extreme weather conditions like the drought and the heat wave that hit Europe, the drought that's currently affecting the Midwest. Right now, I'm in San Francisco doing my book tour for Parallel Worlds.
Yes.
And we've had a monster set of rainfall in Northern California.
Yes.
Unprecedented, in fact.
Well, I'm 20 miles from Death Valley, Professor, and we've never seen anything like it. Roads are washed out. It's like pouring water on marble. It doesn't absorb. It's an amazing time we're having, but I'm always... You know, I'm so afraid to say anything and relate it to a seemingly larger change because, of course, it's only a macro moment in the environment and the weather. It's just a weird moment. Given it's a weird moment, it's hard to convince people that it's part of a bigger picture.
Right. Well, it could be a fluctuation, but these fluctuations are going to become more commonplace. We're going to see more and more of these fluctuations. They're going to be more extreme. Because it's more energy driving these things.
All right, Professor. What about the critics who argue that, yes, greenhouse gases have increased before and the world has gone through many cycles of ice ages and so forth and so on, and yes, maybe we're moving toward an ice age or moving toward whatever, but, you know, this whole thing about man's part in it is so absolute bunk. That's what the skeptics say.
Yeah, but you see, if you take a look at the weather conditions on the planet Earth, again, going back hundreds of thousands of years, it's peaking right at the time of maximum industrial activity. And scientists can now actually measure the increase in temperature almost day by day by looking at rush traffic. I've had one release on the Internet showing that by looking at the carbon dioxide emitted by cars during rush traffic, you can actually see the micro increase in temperature during the daytime because of rush traffic. And weekends, it went down because no one drives their car on weekends so much, but on Monday, and you see these cycles. So we can even see it now day to day. Forget the 5, 10, 100-year cycles now. You can actually see it day to day in terms of micro changes in temperature because of traffic jams and the lofting of enormous amounts of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere.
Well, I wonder, though, if these are local changes or are they the larger picture? In other words, yes, sure, cities with asphalt and buildings and all the things attendant with cities, and then, of course, the emissions as well and the smog and all the rest of it are going to have a sort of sub-environment that's localized pretty much. Does that translate to the world scale?
Well, it does in the sense that you can actually see now in the cities not a constant temperature, but the temperature fluctuations due to cars. You can actually see that now in the evidence. So it's just not asphalt. It's the fact that on weekends, temperatures drop a little bit, and on Mondays, temperatures rise a bit because of the carbon dioxide being generated right before our eyes by economic activity.
No question about it. What I'm asking is, does this translate to the world's environment, or is it a localized only condition?
Well, it shows that carbon dioxide will, in fact, in the real world, raise temperatures.
Oh, I see.
Some people thought that because of cloud activity, because water rises in temperature, creates clouds, clouds reflect the energy back into outer space. Therefore, you get a compensating fact that clouds will cool the Earth, and clouds are created by global warming. But we've taken that factor into account now, and we find that that's not enough. The temperature still rises. Even with cloud activity reflecting light back into outer space, we still see the fact that man-made carbon dioxide has a net increase in temperature even with this cloud activity. That was one of the main scientific criticisms of the greenhouse effect.
Yes.
That there could be compensating effects.
That's right.
Like a cloud activity. But we also have positive feedback. When the tundra of Alaska melts, it releases methane gas. Methane gas is even more of a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide, even more of a greenhouse gas. And so we have an accelerating greenhouse effect in Alaska as the tundra thaws out and methane gas is released. And therefore, it accelerates this whole process.
Now, there are some who even say, hooray for global warming. I mean, I can see that it's bringing changes. I don't care if man's hand is involved. Frankly, where I live, this is just a metaphorical person out there, where I live, I could use several degrees of temperature rise. I would love it. What do you say to those folks?
Well, I think as far as economic activity, Canada could be the main recipient of the benefits. They could have the next breadbasket.
There you are.
Blessed with the Midwest that has a tremendous breadbasket. That's going to turn into a dust bowl. The next breadbasket could be in Canada as Canada heats up. So, yeah, some nations may benefit, but it's not going to be us. Our temperatures are going to be more like Mexico. And Mexico is very hot, as you know, in certain parts.
It sure is.
And they don't have breadbaskets like we have breadbaskets in the Midwest. No, they don't have a corn belt and a wheat belt. And, you know, Canada is going to have huge corn belts and wheat belts.
So it may well be then that a Canadian is absolutely justified in saying, global warming? Huh, bring it on.
Yeah, at the expense of somebody else.
Yes.
You know? Oh, and it could be us.
Yes. But could that Canadian be wrong, or is he totally right? In other words, yeah, sure, bring it on. And, in fact, he will be better off. Or would there be some other unexpected occurrences as a result of this?
Well, many other unexpected occurrences like a disease, malaria, a dengue fever, diseases spread by vectors like mosquitoes will start to rise. West Nile virus was unheard of a few years ago. Now many metropolitan cities have West Nile virus. Many people think that's just the beginning as mosquitoes start to head north, as more diseases start to occur.
I'm one of those people. All right, Professor, hold on. We'll resume in a moment. By the way, yes, of course, we'll open the lines for Professor Michio Kaku, whatever subject you might like to probe. From the high desert, the soggy high desert, this is Coast to Coast AM. I'm Mark Bell.